You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? This week's guest is Jay Acunzo. Jay is the author of the book Break the Wheel: Question Best Practices, Hone Your Intuition, and Do Your Best Work. He is a critically acclaimed show host and executive producer, as well as the founder of Unthinkable Media, which creates documentary shows with brand clients. As a digital media strategist at Google, Jay was responsible for pushing marketing executives and practitioners into the digital age. He then held multiple leadership positions at high-growth tech startups, including HubSpot, and served as vice president of brand at the venture capital firm NextView. Jay's work has been cited in courses at Harvard Business School and by writers at The New York Times, The Washington Post, Fast Company, Fortune, Forbes, and more. He's been called a creative savant by Salesforce and was named to the City of Boston's 50 on Fire list. In a world where storyteller has become a buzzword, Jay has earned a living by understanding how to tell actual stories, emotional tales of people and teams doing their best work that help inspire others to push past conventional thinking in theirs. Jay, welcome to On Brand.
Thanks, Nick. By the way, you have an incredible announcer's voice.
Well, thank you. That's what I need to get out of the down and dirty work of doing all of this branding and marketing work for clients, and instead just find enough of that to spend my day reading great bios like yours.
I call our friend Scott Monty handsome McGolden voice. I feel like we need a nickname for you along
right.
the same lines.
Yeah, well, I need to at least with Scott Monty and Tom Webster kind of being on the A team there. I need to at least be on like the B team bench. If one of those two is busy, I'm certainly available to read whatever you might have. I love speaking as someone that reads a few bios every now and then, and also as a podcast about this branding thing that we talk about. You acknowledge there in that last paragraph that this storytelling, story concept is everywhere. It is certainly a buzzword, and I think that has both good and bad to it, yes?
Well, the good is probably that there's ubiquity and awareness, right?
Right.
Like,
we're
but the bad is, yeah, we're talking about it. The bad is, I think, certainly I'm this way. I feel like a lot of others listening are probably the same way, because everybody listening to a podcast ostensibly is a lifelong learner and critical of the status quo because they want to keep getting better. The anything in a buzzword sense becomes something you easily write off, or something that others bastardize and make it their own in a way that maybe isn't the right intention. Maybe they have ulterior motives. And so, like, to me, the fact that marketers could take a term like storytelling and make it a buzzword is like the culinary world taking the word food and making it a buzzword. It's like, this should be what we do, and there are practical and awesome ways to do this, but for some reason we've changed it and morphed it and warped it into something that it's really not supposed to be, and we shouldn't write it off. We should get back. We should basically take it back is what I'm trying to say.
Well, it's interesting because, yeah, everybody's got, and here's my story formula. Everybody's got their own version of it. And then I think that the audience hearing everyone, all of the great lifelong learners out there listening to podcasts, reading articles, trying to unpack this, is still left scratching their heads a bit and saying, so am I telling more stories? Is my slogan a story? Is that commercial, that video produced? I feel like that's got a story in it somewhere. and they just don't know. They know that they need story on their shopping list, and maybe there's a lot of different places they can get it, but what exactly is it?
Well, I feel like there's one element that a lot of marketers overlook, and it's because people just plaster the word everywhere and don't really mean it or know what it means. I think it's conflict. So you can interpret that word in different ways. Conflict, tension, stakes. But when you have a story, there's a status quo that's then threatened or interrupted by some kind of conflict that raises the arc in a narrative arc. And then there's a resolution to that conflict. And a lot of times in the business world, especially, we think about story, we're just handing out status quos. We're just handing out statements of fact. And then we're leaping to the resolution and be like, so because of that, like, come to my world, believe what I believe. And it really doesn't reel people in. There's no emotional investment on the side of the audience and the creator, I'd argue. And it just misses, I think, the only element of when you communicate that creates story, which is that conflict, the tension, the stakes, like giving people a reason to care to march forward in this linear thing that you're building.
Yeah. And it's almost like, I feel like it can be missed on the business side of things because conflict is scary. I mean, conflict, almost every sense that it's used is about how to resolve, how to avoid, and understanding the conflict and the role it plays in story, I think is key. And a lot of times we don't want to make people feel bad. We want to not remind them of tension, but that same tension provides the hook into the story that we need to tell that can provide some sort of benefit for them.
Well, I think, you know, I love what you just put your finger on, which is we don't want to feel bad ourselves as the creators, and we don't want others to feel bad. So let's just sort of whitewash this quote unquote story here, remove the tension. But think about Disney movies, nursery rhymes, like think about things that are squarely in the camp of feel good.
Yeah,
they all have some kind of conflict. I mean, I think probably my favorite Disney movie is Lion King. You realize, dear listener, that in The Lion King, the Disney writers for a children's movie murdered the dad of the protagonist by getting trampled.
Right? Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
We don't look back at Lion King and be like, it's a horrible, horrible film. Oh my gosh, the gore. No. The Itsy Bitsy Spider, whilst traversing the water spout, almost drowned. Like,
yeah.
Down came the rain. Nobody would say, like, the Itsy Bitsy Spider went up the water spout on a sunny day and he made it up. Like, who cares about, no one cares about that. But that is the equivalent of a lot of marketers' quote unquote storytelling efforts. And it's a real problem. We're not giving people a reason to care. We're not resonating.
Well, it makes me think when we talk about this, one of my favorite examples to point to is actually a brand that came up in your bio, Salesforce. And Salesforce, I think, a big part of their messaging, you know, I think back to the days of the, I think they've moved beyond this, but the no software circle with the slash through it, had, I mean, in the story sense, that is an enemy. That's something that they are fighting against and working towards. It gives the stakes and works towards the resolution, like you said.
Well, I went through this when writing Break the Wheel because it's the biggest thing I've ever written, 264 pages. And every story, ultimately, that's what I like to do most is tell stories. And so I looked at who does this well while also teaching. And you have the Gladwellian approach, which is I'm telling you a story, then breaking from it and giving you the insights. But I really like what Charles Duhigg does as a writer. He weaves together story and an analyst kind of approach, like analysis and insights together. So you're kind of bobbing between them on en route to the resolution of the story. So you never actually leave the story. So I wanted to try my hand at that. But if you zoom all the way out, every story I tell in the book, everybody has the same enemy. So every story you tell as a brand, everybody has the same enemy. And you can create that enemy overtly by addressing whatever it is you're battling against as a brand and trying to fight for the better way with your product or service. But you can also do it implicitly just by creating some questions in people's minds. Like, it doesn't have to be we're sending in the protagonist's father for his untimely death. Like, it doesn't have to be quite so dire. It could just be as simple as, actually, I just published a podcast episode talking about the story of Jack Conte, the CEO and founder of Patreon. And the first words out of my mouth were, what am I? Now, like, you have no idea what I'm talking about, but I'm creating some kind of, I'm literally giving you a question and I'm creating intrigue enough that you're like, what is he talking about? Like the species he is, the job he has, like, also, why doesn't he know what he is? Like, you start to create intrigue and open-endedness. In journalism, I learned that this is called an open loop, which is when you start somebody down this nice little loop and don't close it, maybe until later. You leave something open-ended or hanging. And I think, you know, in the marketer sense, the awful version, the disrespectful version for the audience is like a clickbait headline is an open loop. But there are other ways to create those moments. And, you know, presenting an enemy or something unknown or some conflict is a great, great way to do that.
Well, and as I love the podcast application too. We'll make sure to link up to that episode here. But I think that that closed loop methodology is also very, I would imagine it's very effective in the audio format of storytelling. I feel like I hear that a lot, where I have something in a cold open, something at the beginning, that then there's a payoff at the end after some detail, some context, and other content has been provided.
Audio is almost like the most naked of mediums. You know, I suppose, I don't mean that literally, although I suppose you wouldn't have any way of telling, but if the person
right.
was, but
what you know. Don't know is that, dear listener, we're both naked right now. That
welcome
is not
to
true.
The Pantsless Podcast. it's going down a weird road.
Exactly.
What I mean, though, is like audio strips away a lot of the things that, while useful if you know how to use them, if you're craft-driven as a creator, they often clutter the story, and all it leaves is your voice. Now, obviously, you can add in sound design and music and other flourishes, multiple voices, lots of post-production moving around those voices, but ultimately, you're just listening to a thing that is then creating some kind of image in your head. It's like the ultimate theater of the mind, audio. And so as a result, you start to notice these things more overtly. But I think it comes through in video. You know, my favorite documentarian of all time, favorite storyteller of all time is Anthony Bourdain. And he would open with really beautiful B-roll that his production team would capture of a location and people. And you didn't quite know what was going on. You were trying to latch on to different things like, oh, they're at a food truck. Okay, I know food trucks. Or like, but I don't know that skyline or that mountain range. I'm not sure what's happening. And he would say like, Uruguay. And you'd be like, oh, okay, I know where I am now. And he'd be like, it used to be that we thought this about that country. And you're like, huh, all right, interesting, I learned something. And it's like, but thanks to this new thing, everything is changing. And you're like, whoa, what's changing? I got to keep paying attention after the opening, after the theme song, after the commercial break. He's purchased more of my attention, which is essentially what stories do.
Yeah, well, and I love the Anthony Bourdain example because I actually cited that in my book Brand Now about these extrapolations of being the analogies, the metaphors, the someone of something. And the interesting idea there is I've come to realize that always known metaphors, analogies are strong, but in looking at what they're doing, they're really kind of like a small contained dose of story, because it takes a story of, okay, I know Anthony Bourdain, I know what he's about, that Jay is the Anthony Bourdain of what he's trying to do, that connects you to his story in an interesting and kind of fast-tracked way.
Right, and the punchiest way I've ever heard someone describe that, there was a nonprofit, I believe it's no longer running, called Falling Whistles, that I think it helped with violence in the Congo, I believe. And the founder, I'm going to forget his name, it's something like Sean Carrasco or Carrasso. I feel bad that I can't remember his name, but he had a brilliant phrase. I saw him speak once, and he said, stories illuminate commonalities we'd otherwise not see. And like, that's the beauty of swapping stories with friends over drinks. That's the beauty of telling a story when you open an article or a podcast or a speech. That's also the beauty of an analogy or a metaphor, because it kind of, like you said, it's like this compact little, like almost like a space bag of a story that compresses a lot of complexity, a lot of emotion, a lot of things you need to understand into something very compact and tight. And instantly you have room for that in your brain, and instantly you get on board and you understand. So it really quickly illuminates that commonality that you'd otherwise not see, or that understanding you otherwise wouldn't have.
All of the fast tracking, the space blanket, and then on the other side, you remember it better as well, because it's all because of everything that we just mentioned coming in and internalizing that, we're able to keep and sort that in a way that that's harder to do using almost any other method.
First of all, I could talk about this for 16 hours straight. I love this. But I think about the ending of a podcast. I talked about the beginning and creating that intrigue, introducing the conflict or the stakes. But also when we end a podcast as marketers, oftentimes we stuff it similar to the intro. And both times I think it's a mistake. We stuff it too full of A, just stuff, and B, we don't end on the most powerful note. You know, there's that old saying, it's not how you start, it's how you finish. Well, I think in podcasting, in creating any linear experience with someone, it's also how you start. Yeah, it's both. And so you start well, but when you end a podcast, like when I construct the endings to my show, I like to reach what I call exit velocity. Like I want to get you so fired up or thinking so critically or experiencing something so delicious in that final moment that you remember it. Instead of what most people do is they kind of, and they do this on the stage, they do this in the show, they do this in articles, they kind of like rush to get out of there or don't know what to say. It's like, okay, we're at time. That's all I got. Thanks. Hey, yeah. Nick, thanks for coming on the show, Nick. Great chatting with you. And it's like, there's a powerful moment Nick just shared that I just need to shut up, which if you can't tell, I'm bad at doing, and and let Nick share that moment so that people are like, wow, that hit me where I live. I'm going to remember this moment.
Well, I like that. I like the idea of exit velocity. And I think that we've finally gotten it into our heads for the most part that the first impression matters. You never get a second chance to make a first impression. We get that hammered home. There's all kinds of science, but primacy works on both sides of that as well. It's your first impression and it's the most recent. It's what you left someone with as well. And yeah, we I think load up on the front end and kind of run out of steam as we finish up. That's all I got. See ya.
Exactly.
Flash the logo up at the end. It's done. Did I lose you?
Oh, sorry. I just started talking on mute.
No.
or we just dropped the listener off a cliff and now there's some intrigue. What's going on?
I was gonna say it was an ironic moment because we were talking about endings and then it just abruptly appeared to end. So
we're always performing in meta fashion, aren't we?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I always mark down your edit points, and I feel like this might be one that that our mutual friend Ann Handley would call flossom. So we might need to keep that flaw in there and in all of its meta wonderfulness. Well,
I love
that. Talking about exit velocity and talking about just the fact that we're both talking, I want to make sure that we don't skip or run out of time to talk about what's happened with you since you were last here. And that is, of course, you've mentioned it a couple of times, but what is Break the Wheel all about?
So I think we all get on board with a very simple idea, but then we don't know how to execute on it. And it's become even harder in the information age, which is that I think we'd all agree that finding best practices isn't the goal and finding the best approach for you is. And so the question I've always wondered is like, okay, yeah, but how can you do that? Right? We all understand like finding someone's blueprint hopefully isn't just about like step-by-step adherence to that blueprint. It's about molding it and shaping it and tailoring it, or any idea or any you know concept that a guru hands us or that we have with our team. It's about shaping it to our specific context. But there's a lot of commodity work out there. There's a lot of average stuff. We kind of always retreat to the mean as marketers because we keep trying to keep up with all the stuff that's out there. You know, we're in this endless cycle of best practices and conventional thinking and trendy new tactics that we keep glomming onto. And in writing Break the Wheel, I wanted to step outside of that, break that wheel, and see what does it actually take to think for yourself when you're surrounded by conventional thinking, not because you want to be a rebel, but because you want whatever you're doing to work in your specific context. So that's what the book is about, is how do you make better decisions faster to make it work for you, regardless of the best practice, because that's our goal.
Yeah, that's such an interesting loop that we're kind of stuck in. Again, the ideas, the best practices, the new stuff, but really bringing it in and making it work for you, I think is kind of where we run out of road a little bit. So how do you, in the absence of the road, a plan there. Where do you start?
Well, you just gave us the words. You start with not the out there, not with what works in general or on average. You start with the for you part. You know, we so often look at, and there's real psychological reasons I uncovered that were pretty eye-opening doing research for this book for why we do this. But we so often look at, you know, our answers are coming from out there, the expert, the precedent, the, you know, the consensus, the trend. And I think there's really important variables right in front of our noses every day in our context, but we don't really investigate that stuff. And I think if there's any switch I'm encouraging people to make, it's to stop acting like experts and start acting like investigators. Because while an expert offers helpful advice, sure, everything I've said so far might be helpful advice, but it's ultimately, you know, generic about storytelling. You might say, Jay, in my context, actually the way you constructed your story framework doesn't make sense for me. And I'd be wise to say, okay, great. What is it about your situation that leads you to believe that? But really often we aren't equipping ourselves with that knowledge. So if you look at your context, and instead of acting like an expert who knows absolutes, you act like an investigator who asks really good questions and finds those answers from their situation. Now you open up a world of possibilities and you give yourself like a mental filter to vet any other idea. Like in a world of endless ideas and answers, the real skill isn't finding them, it's vetting them. And how do we do that? I think you have to start with an intimate understanding of your context. And so that's what I tried to explore in the book, is how do we go about that?
Well, I love the point of experts versus investigators, because it makes me think of a couple of things. It makes me think of the other favorite Jay Akunzo quote from the last episode of whying things to death, of continuing to ask why behind things. And I do think, especially with as visible as experts are, I think there's folks listening out there that recognize, maybe in themselves or others, that a lot of us go into meetings, go into strategy sessions with that expert mindset of mirroring what we heard someone else say, what it's supposed to sound like, instead of the ability to contextualize, to ask those questions about what works and why and why and why.
Right. My classic example comes from my own background working for marketing tech vendors, which is the list article. I think there's a tendency, maybe more acutely historically, but I think it's still around, to cling on to this idea that, well, the data says list articles do really well, publish more list articles. But it's far more valuable to understand why something works than the mere fact that it works. Because then you start to think, you start to investigate, well, why does a list article work? And the scary thing about asking why, or other similar open-ended questions, which I call trigger questions because they literally spark your curiosity or launch your investigation. But when you ask a trigger question, you're kind of admitting to yourself or your colleagues, hey, I actually don't know the answer. I don't know why, but I know how to figure it out. And I always felt that was our missing piece. We like the security or the false sense of precision provided by a best practice. It's the list article, like just publish more. But it is a false sense of precision. And so what if we could have something equally concrete that has to this point felt ephemeral, which is, I don't know all the answers, but I have a system in place for figuring it out, right? And again, if you're acting like an investigator, you're not asking as an investigator, what is the best tactic for B2B lead gen in 2019? You're not asking that. You're asking like, why did that list article work? Or what is our aspiration together as a team? Or what change are we trying to instill in the market or in our customers? These are open-ended questions that can't be Googled. There is no expert handing you a list. You have to reflect on it or test and learn in firsthand fashion. So I don't have all the answers, but I know how to figure it out. To me, that's the most powerful skill any marketer could possess.
All of this makes me think of a quote. I think it's James Thurber, but I'll let someone correct me. That is that it's better to have some of the questions than all of the answers.
Ooh, and I love that.
And you almost literally just said it word for word there with having the questions instead of all those answers, because that gets at the activities around experts versus.
I'd reflect back another quote, Charlie Munger from Berkshire Hathaway, yeah. You know, Warren Buffett's right-hand man. He likes to say, I'd rather be vaguely right than precisely wrong.
Oh, that's good.
Because he knows, like, when you have the answer, you hold it up and repeat it. Like, what you're not doing is constantly course correcting as new information comes your way or as the context changes. So in his mind, great progress is zigzaggy, right? You're constantly course correcting and investigating new information versus like crystallizing this just like, you know, insistence that no, we have the blueprint, just follow it.
I also feel like as we get into dueling quotes there, I feel like they also like metaphor analogies, a good quote, some are too long, some are too, you know, ramble a little bit, but they do some of the same things that stories do, that they illuminate things and in a neat and tidy little package that someone can take with them as well.
Right. It's another space bag for your brain. Although just like storytelling, I should cite Tamsin Webster is someone who gave me that phrase, space bags for your brain. She's brilliant. And I would also say like quotes of something or something that a lot of organizations or individuals have gnarled, just like storytelling. Like you could see a Mad Lib version of
right.
someone who gets on a stage and just says like, don't X because of Y. Why? Because of X. And it's like, oh, what?
Yeah.
Right. No, but you haven't said anything real. Right. So quotes, if they say something real, are powerful, just like stories, if they're actual stories, are so powerful.
Well, it's like not all quotes are created equally either. I think, you know, there's some that it's like, okay, I'm going to put a paragraph up on screen. Let's read all this together. But no, that the Charlie Munger quote is great. Well, as we wrap up here, it's a great example. Berkshire Hathaway stories are brands that make me smile. Jay, what is a brand that has made you smile recently?
I've recently gotten into this idea that there are certain companies out there that do things that you would call refreshing. It's not like different, which is, you know, I could turn my back on a stage to the audience. I'd be different, but I wouldn't be good. I wouldn't be welcome. So I think like refreshing work is that kind of work that says it's different, but welcome. It's like everybody should do it that way. Every time. And one of my, I've long admired a company probably many people listening have heard of, which is Wistia. But so people might know Wistia for their short form educational videos. They're a video hosting and analytics platform. And they also just released a new product to create video. But, and they've also created just a huge backlog of educational videos that are short and snappy and entertaining and warm. But they've recently made a decision to reinvent themselves, essentially. So the market caught up to what they saw as working. And unlike most companies who would just cling to the playbook and squeeze it to death, they said, okay, we have to continue to push the envelope forward. We're the market leaders. And they launched a documentary series at the end of last year called 110 100. They literally paid a video agency called Sandwich $1,000. They wanted to make three videos for the same product, one for $1,000, one for $10,000, one for $100,000, 110, 100, and see how money affects the creative process. And so Sandwich created those videos, which promoted the product of Wistia. Then Wistia created a behind-the-scenes documentary about that theme of how money changes creativity. And I just freaking loved it. And it spoke to their willingness to be like, we used to do short form, but the world has changed, context has changed. We need to create documentaries now, shows. It's unbelievable.
Well, and especially, man, you get to whying something to death and looking at, especially in the tech space, video tech. And yeah, I totally see it. It caught up with them. But looking at what are the next questions? What are several questions out from where people that are working with video in a savvy way that they're thinking about? And they're thinking about questions like that. So that's such an interesting frame to put all of that in. I love it. Different, but welcome. Jay, where can folks go to learn more about who you are, what you do, and breaking the wheel?
I put a lot of behind-the-scenes information because I know a lot of people listening are marketers who make stuff. So when you make things for makers, you give them what you made, but you can also give them like how you made it. So if you go to jayakunzo.com/book, there's all the information you could possibly want about me and that book, but also some stuff behind the scenes. My favorite being like my Spotify playlist that I use to write the book in a coffee shop. So I tried to give away everything I possibly could. jayakunzo.com/book.
Everything in the playlist is at jayakunzo.com/book. We will link up to all of that in our show notes. Jay, thank you for joining us on Brand.
Thanks, Nick.
And a reminder, if you like something that you heard on this episode or another, if you have a question you'd like one of our guests to answer, let me know using the hashtag #OnBrandPodcast, and you may just hear your thoughts right here on the show. You can subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Speaking of iTunes, if you like what you're hearing, head over there, give us a quick rating and review, help others find the show. Keeping in mind my own exit velocity, I'm Nick Westergaard, and until next week, I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.